Hello and welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple. We are in the all new season of The Thriller Zone, and I could not be happier. Boy, do we have a lineup for you. In July, forget about it. August, forget about it. September, October, no, we are booked well into the fall, and I could not be happier. I want to start out of the gate by saying thank you. Thank you for being there. Thank you for supporting this podcast by sponsorship or by listenership. Thank you for your 4- and 5-star reviews. Thank you for your emails and your kind gestures. I'm blessed, I'm humbled, and I thank you very much. We have such a lineup for you this year. You're probably wondering, hey, is David going to kick off the new season with some monster talent? Yes, I am, actually. Have you heard of him? No, you haven't. But I'm going to tell you about him after this. Coming up this month, here's somebody you've heard of, Dean Koontz, author of The Big Dark Sky. I got a chance to sit down with Dean Koontz, and you are going to be amazed at some of the things that you're going to learn about Dean that maybe you didn't know. Next week, this just in, Brad Thor, Rising Tiger. Oh, baby, I'm excited about this. I have been thinking about talking to Brad Thor. I know, excuse the geek out. I've been thinking and hoping about talking to him maybe a year. So finally, Brad Thor has opened his schedule for us. But as I said, as part of our Discovery New Author series, Brian LeBeau has written a book called A Disturbing Nature. And if you're a fan of serial killer thrillers, you're going to like this book. So what do you say? Without any further ado, let's get on into the Thriller Zone for this new season with Brian LeBeau.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
I can, Brian. How are you, sir?
I'm excellent. Is the sound okay? To be fair, the ladies usually set me up.
But
the one that does it has COVID. Her and her kids have COVID. So
tell her to get out of bed and get down here. That's no excuse. No.
She's almost over it.
Yep. Get your ass out of bed. Come down here and fix the microphone. Don't you know who this is? This is Brian LeBeau.
I sense you're picking up my Boston accent.
I'm trying to. I'm not very good at it, but I'm just going to keep going at riffing with you until I figure it out. Hey, how was your 4th of July holiday?
It was very good. Went over to a friend's house. They had a great purview over the town here, Ramona, and they shot up fireworks from the high school. It was amazing. It was actually really good. The kids were in the pool the whole time.
Nice. Daddy didn't get in the pool?
Dad gets in his own pool. He doesn't normally get in other people's pools.
Dad's a wee bit of a germaphobe. It's okay. It's just who I am.
No, I like to go in at night when everybody else is asleep and just relax when the water's super warm. I'm not much for going in when there's 40 people in the pool.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you're naked. That's a whole different thing.
Nobody wants to swim naked but me. So it's uncomfortable for them.
Hey, listen, don't take this the wrong way, but I would come swim naked with you just because, you know, it'd be fun.
Why do you need anything to inhibit the enjoyment of being in a pool?
Brian LeBeau, and his book is A Disturbing Nature. This is his debut. That means he is a new member of the Discovery New Author series. So this is a dandy little read. Dude, I got to tell you, can I just be frank with you?
Yeah.
Let's be frank and earnest. I'll be frank. You be earnest. Okay.
All right. That was my father's name.
Thank you. 480 pages. And this is going to show my age, but tiny print. I had to stop a couple of times to let my eyes rest a little bit.
No, I get it. You don't want to pass 500. The cost of producing them goes up substantially if it crosses 500.
I will say this. I probably shouldn't go off on this tangent, but I'm fresh off of 3-day holiday, so I've got energy and enthusiasm, and you seem like a super swell guy that I can just be myself with. But I got to tell you, your next one, cut it down a little bit. Would you make it a little more digestible? I'm kidding. I'm totally
kidding. No, that's okay. The second, because the 4-book series runs off of the same characters, the second book and third book are much shorter. One was 147,000 words. Oi, did I not turn this
off? Oi. Honey, turn off my phone, would you? I have the girls do my phone.
Where are they today? In any event, the second book right now is going into edit. It's about 105,000 words. So that's pretty much much closer. But the first one required, because it's a true psychological thriller, all that upfront material to really get to know the characters and inside the heads of the main characters. So I went back and forth on, do I distribute that across four books? And I said, no, not in the end. I think it means more.
Well, I will say this. I run across a number of debut authors, and none are quite as prolific in depth as this. There's no right or wrong. There's no good or bad. I don't care if you write 200 pages or you write 700 pages. The chances of my reading your 700 pages are going to be more challenging because I'm reading several a week. But that notwithstanding, that sounds so professorial, didn't it?
It really did. And having been a professor, it was right on.
Brian, that notwithstanding, you'll find. What I want to say is that it's a great compilation of feelings. And we're going to get into that in a second. So I don't want to get ahead of myself. But I do want to say you're from Massachusetts, in case anyone hasn't figured out that yet. What is it about the R's? Do you guys just at birth take the R's and throw them away and go, they're not needed?
I think there's just a preference towards AH. I don't know why anybody would not understand that. The R is an overused word. It's different in every language. It's whatever your language is. But for, you know, when you're up in Massachusetts, just throw them away. They don't matter. Use the AH and everybody's fine.
I hope you're not offended by the way I'm busting your chops. It's just fine. Yeah.
Now, I've been living in Southern California now for almost 15 years, and I still hear it from everyone.
Wait a minute. Where are you?
I live in Ramona, just outside of San Diego, California.
Dude, you know where I am, don't you?
I do not.
I'm in Encinitas.
Oh, come on. I could have walked over there.
Forget about it. Are you kidding me?
Oh, I'm dead serious.
Dude, if I had known this, okay. All right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to make you a deal. When your next book comes out, we're going to sit down together face to face. We won't have the girls to have to worry about doing our technology because I'll do it.
I can promise you'd prefer the girls be there.
Okay, we'll bring the girls, but we're going to do it face-to-face.
Particularly if we're going to go swimming in your pool.
Yeah. Oh, my God, dude. That is so... If I had known that, I don't know why I thought... I don't think I ran across... It's probably on your Facebook page. All right, my apologies. I'm an investigator. I should know this stuff, Brian.
You know, honestly, I should have checked on it. I looked through the website. I did not pick up that it was right here either.
That notwithstanding, we're going to do it in person next time. That'll be a lot of fun. All right, so... Here's another thing. So this is a psychological thriller, which we've talked about. It's called A Disturbing Nature, and it is. You merge three big interests as you as a person, which is kind of what I dig, because it allows me to get to know you quickly. Fascination with World War II, morbid curiosity with serial killers, which we all have and we're going to get to in a second, and I was going to say lifelong obsession with the Boston Red Sox, but that kind of makes sense because you grew up there, so it only makes sense, right?
Yep.
But here's the intriguing thing, folks, when you get to read A Disturbing Nature, is how Brian blends several elements and incorporates them in an unusual fashion. Now, I'm going to tee you up. I'm not the kind of guy who goes, well, I read that such and such, but I want to tee you up so that you can go from there. But what I dig is that, you borrow from a couple of guys, some of our listeners have heard about, Steinbeck, Hemingway, okay, and Chandler and Leonard and so forth. But I'd love to get your intake, your input, your take on how you were able to pull the influences of those classic masters in without copying into your thriller.
You know, that was hard. When I wrote the first draft, this is 30 plus years from started jotting down the concept, and then 4.5 years of actually writing it. 55 months was the actual count.
Wow.
And that was with people helping me. I had a team of editors and folks helping me. I wrote the original draft. It was 200 plus thousand words, and it was linear. It ran through Mo Luhmann's life. And obviously I knew that wasn't correct. We sent it out to readers. They loved the story. They hated the length and that I wrote in too high a level and all these things. And so when it came time to really understand what it took to write, I had two options. I could go back to school for writing, creative writing, or I could hire a few best-selling authors to show me how to write suspense. And that's what I did. And I did not let them ghostwrite. I told one particularly, who's an 8-time number one New York Times bestseller, that I don't want you to write this. What I want you to do is tell me what I'm doing wrong and I'll correct it. And by doing that, I was able to start over the course of about 2 years, really developing a different voice. I won't say unique, but a different voice. And to do that, I just pulled from my favorite authors from the past. Now, in the case of Raymond Chandler, I'll give you a very good example. When you look at Palmer, Palmer has this perception of the world that everybody, yes.
And let me interject something just so everyone knows. The two primary characters, Mo Luhmann, the antagonist, and Detective Francis Palmer, the protagonist. Continue. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that, because I think people are going to miss the fact that it's Palmer that carries on this series as we move forward.
Right.
So with Palmer, I had read much of Chandler, and so I went back and reread a couple of his, what I consider masterpieces, although people don't tend to like Chandler as much as others. Chandler's thing was that, yeah, I know it's weird, but it's true. He tends to get shortchanged when it comes to, you know, literature. And so I went back and read him, and it was interesting that as you read him entering in, and I'm not going to remember which book it is, but he enters the mansion at the beginning. We've all seen it with Humphrey Bogart. I can't think of the name off the top of my head. But he walks in and he spends like 8 pages describing the facade of the mansion. Well, readers won't go through that today. They're not interested in that. So what I had to do was take Chandler and make him more terse and trite for today's audience. And so if you look at Palmer's writing, the style on Palmer's side, it's very short sentences, and it's almost jarring in the way that it carries you through not only what he's thinking, but whenever we're seeing the setting, whether he's looking at Langford's mansion and comparing it to his home, these are done in a matter of 8 or 9 sentences, a very quick paragraph, so that you're never left hanging there trying to get too descriptive.
Well, and I like that. And it's so interesting. It is a true shift in societal norms that we have gone from really appreciating this languorous tale telling to this, come on, get to the point. Because I suppose it's a couple of things, and I'm slightly overstating the obvious. Shorter attention spans, more competition for our attention, and in that competition for attention, you know, we've got more channels of information coming at us. We got TV, we got streaming, we got movies, we got phones. The phones are kind of slowly ruining us in a lot of different ways. But so I dig that, and I think it's intuitive of you to follow the society push, while still you haven't sacrificed the literary craftsmanship, because like I mentioned, at sub 500 pages, you're getting plenty of languorousness, not even a word, in there.
When you look at Luhmann's side, the same is true on Palmer's side, despite the fact there's a clear difference in style. I don't know if you recognized it, but you're looking at two different voices. And that's what took 2 years, was to come up with the distinct voices for those, using an omniscient narrator, which, oddly enough, when I sent it out to be edited through the publisher, she was more than halfway through the book and she sent me a message saying, why did you decide to start using an omniscient narrator now on chapter? And I wrote back and I said, well, I take that as a compliment that you didn't even pick up there was an omniscient narrator from the beginning. You never see the word I used in the book. Not unless it's in dialogue. And so I said, that was the third language that I had to learn to write over the course of 2 years. How do you put in an omniscient narrator that represents my ability to be in the story and tell the story, but more importantly, allows the reader to be right in the settings. So when you're watching dialogue take place on either side, what I was attempting to do was to make it that you actually felt like you were there, because you're seeing every motion and you're watching what's occurring between, and then you're also getting the thoughts of the primary character for that particular chapter until they meld, and then you're getting one primarily and the other only when it accentuates.
You know, folks, this is almost, I don't want to be grandiose about this, but it's almost a master's class. I mean, it is so obvious, Brian, that this book took you a long time. Not the fact that it's your first one. I mean, our first ones generally take us longer than the next ones, but you've really put in the time and the research and the layering, atmosphere, characters, different voices. Anyway, I it's something to be proud of. There you go.
Well, I appreciate that. I think I sometimes worry that readers today, having read quite a few more recent works, both in the suspense and thriller category, but also recently to help out some independent authors, I've been reading other books in other genres. The only one that I have trouble with between you and me is smut romance, because I'm sorry, but you can only do that so many times. To me.
Did Did you say smart romance?
No, smut romance.
Oh, smut.
It sounds like what it is, right? Okay. And I get it. It's a genre. I don't have to like certain types of music, but I respect the fact that people do and that there are those people that do it well. But for me, to pick up that is a little difficult because as I'm reading it, I'm going, okay, where have I not seen this when I was 15 years old reading Penthouse Letters? And to me, honestly, that was better. So because it was more direct. So, you know, I think it just comes down to personal taste. And there are those people that will never pick up a horror book, those that will never pick up a suspense book or mystery. And I totally get that, but I respect all of it, right? Everybody's got to build their voice. In this case here, what I was worried about is I want to write tales that are allegorical. And so if you were to take my favorite novel of all time, it's either To Kill a Mockingbird or The Great Gatsby. It's going to be one or the other. And so in trying to do that, I think people sometimes miss the symbolism. But you want them to have a good story to read, and they will mistake the paths that you go down, that you have to sit there and learn the relationships and the background, because you're building an allegorical tale that spreads out across four books.
Well, let me tell you something that hit me between the eyes when I very first discovered you, and I don't recall exactly at this moment how I discovered you, but I am a nut. If you've listened to the have you heard the show before?
I've listened to a few, yes.
Okay. One of my favorite things is covers. And when I saw your cover, for those who can see this at home, this cover, for whatever reason, I don't have an original copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. But
I have it here.
All right, go grab it, because this reminds me of this for some reason. There's a time period sensibility of this that I can't put my finger on.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, for God.
I have the one that would have been read in the early 60s by his dad.
Wait a minute, you don't have the original.
The other one's at home, but I do have it. And that's what I style that after. In fact, a lot of people have picked up on that and said, you know, that reminds me of To Kill a Mockingbird. It was purposeful because I felt this is going to sound haughty. I do not mean it to be, because nobody writing their first book should aim this high. But I looked at Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn as being the great pre-Civil War work on racism. And then you take the Jim Crow law period, and I think most people would agree that To Kill a Mockingbird was that.
All right. I was 100% with you. In case you thought I was distracted, I was trying to find, this is That's what it, you're looking yes. for, right? Yeah.
That is correct.
And I'm going to pull this up in its original form on the screen as I edit the show. But, and isn't it funny, rhetorical, isn't it funny that as I saw this cover, when it came out, it was burned in my brain. We must have had this copy around the house. So when I saw this, I'm like, why does that feel strangely familiar? And excuse me for going on and on about it, but I knew that you had purpose behind it because you were so purposeful in your writing. So I'm like, okay, there's a very specific reason. And I dropped the ball on digging deeper on where that cover would have come from, but I could have spent quite a bit of time doing it.
Well, I can tell you just very quickly that the cover I actually came up with in 1989 when I had the dream. I woke up and that cover was already in my head. And it's because I had all these seminal moments that were collected. I woke up in a sweat. It was a nightmare. And, you know, when I woke up, I had all these memories of things that occurred that I didn't understand as a young man. And now being older, I had these questions. Why would that happen? Why would it be that way? And I jotted all those things down. And that cover, exactly the way it looks, because that's the Kelly's Ford Bridge in Virginia. Yeah. And the funny part is in 1989, I had never been to Virginia.
Oh,
I know. It was weird. So when it came time to get the graphics person to put it together, and I kept being very specific, and they wouldn't get it. And I'd say, no, you got to have this angle because we need to see this island. And we need to see the noose. We need to see the bridge running across because it's the boundary between northern and southern. That river, Rappahannock, represents the sins of our fathers, which in this case most clearly is racism. That's the black-haired critters floating down the Rappahannock. But in Northern Virginia, there were virtually no, if you go back and look at the statistics, blacks that were hung. I think there were three in the Jim Crow law period. Whereas if you look at Alabama or Mississippi, clearly it was much higher. So it wasn't a big issue. So the stories that his father's telling him are probably not true about his grandparents, but they represent how that racism comes across the bridge and becomes what it is in the North.
Yeah, that is so. See, that's just rich with allegory, et cetera. And I love that. And having grown up, I was born in Winston-Salem, but I grew up in Lynchburg, Virginia. Speaking of weird coincidences. Lynchburg, Virginia. Yeah. Don't get me started. All right. Let's move on to this, because when I mentioned to my listeners these names, just bear with me a second and think about what comes to your mind. Buddy, Gary, Dahmer, Berkowitz. You think of serial killers, and then you think, what do those feelings conjure up, which is dread and fear. Why do you think, Brian, and I'm curious, because you have a more than an obsession. You have a fond appreciation for, I suppose, serial killers. And I'm kind of like you. I can't get enough documentaries about serial killers. What is our fascination with that?
Well, I think, honestly, it comes down to three words. Unfortunate misunderstood victims. I know that sounds weird. We always want to look through the world in a lens that's black and white. And yet, as we understand more and more about the background, the behavior, the experiences of serial killers, you can't help but be thankful. I mean, you don't necessarily go, oh, I feel so bad for them, but you're so thankful that you did not have the father that treated you the way they were treated, that you were given the opportunity to commiserate with people that strengthened your character, that you didn't become reserved and step away and get into your own mind and start to rationalize what the difference between right and wrong was and maybe slant the wrong way. I don't know that we've taken enough time. That was the distinction I wanted to get with the serial killers. Another thing I think people will not understand is this book series starts on the day that Ted Bundy is arrested, August 16, 1975. It ends in the fourth book on the day that he is given the death penalty. Wow. What I wanted to do was take a period that is not the most well written about. People love to write about World War II, post-World War II, 1950s America, 60s across the Cultural Revolution and everything else. They jump to the 80s and the Reagan Revolution and the 80s make it. But the 70s kind of get missed out because it was a stagnant time in America. Things were closing down, things were opening up, but we weren't seeing the worst of those, whether it was the Vietnam War or it was the recession that we had in the early 1980s or inflation.
And one of my favorite television shows on serial killer came along, I want to say last year or 2 years ago, Mindhunter. I loved that show. And it wasn't, my wife and I were sitting there watching, and all of a sudden we realized that, wait a minute, they're not using the phrase serial killers. They were using the phrase.
Was it mass murderer?
Maybe it was mass murderer, but that show related to me the fact that serial killer phrase did not come either right in that show or by the end of that show. Wasn't that the show that kind of discovered that and said?
Well, it is those individuals that were involved initially in bringing the psychotherapy behavioral unit into the FBI. So a lot of their shows are dating back to a period where it would have not been customary to use the term serial killer. Right. This term serial killer was first used with John Wayne Gacy. It was used within the FBI as they were profiling him, and they had gotten to a point where they could indicate, because they had been watching him for a while, that he was in fact a serial killer, a person who was just going to serially keep killing. Yeah. And then it became widespread when it went to court. And then it became general public consumption. The serial killer was a term used for individuals like this, but it would have not been for Ted Bundy.
Here's a question for you out of left field, Red Sox left field, of course. If you were a serial killer, what would be the dark that drives you, do you suppose? And would you concoct a catchy name? Two-part question, you're on.
Wow, there's one that I have not been asked, and I haven't even asked myself. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that everybody, myself included, and it makes it hard when you're writing about a serial killer's thoughts, or at least a presumed serial killer's thoughts, right? I'll leave it at that so that we don't give anything away. But this is going to be recurring throughout the series. It's hard because you're going back to look at times in your life when you haven't been the best version of yourself. Mm-hmm. When you've let something inside you control a decision that you make. So I always try to point to a couple of things. One, when you're very, very young and you get the bully at school, now some of us, maybe we were the bully, but that's already the monster being unleashed. So that's pretty easy one. Yeah. But for most of us, we were the victim of a bully at some point in our life, even if it was a verbal abuse or whatever. When you're going through that, if it gets bad enough, you can probably recall thinking, God, if that kid would just move away, or if that kid would die, my life would be so much better.
Or I forget, just kill him, yeah.
Yeah, so you try to go, and you don't necessarily think about yourself killing him. You just hope somebody else will kill him.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, will enter into the series.
Yes.
Right? Because we want to really investigate all of these kind of dark elements. The other side is when sometimes you know that you didn't do what you would do for somebody else because you don't necessarily like the personality of the person that's involved. In other words, if I was an employer and we had 400 employees, there would be a certain number that I liked, either because in a view from someone else's perspective, they assimilated, they were part of the process of moving forward, they were part of the team. And then there were those that just didn't have the right personality, and maybe you didn't give them the same opportunities. Maybe you didn't give, you didn't listen as well when they were talking. And to me, that's kind of allowing maybe a dark part of yourself to come out, because in reality, in that setting, we should be equal to everyone. We like to believe that we no longer have any hate or jealousy or prejudice or, come on. We have to accept the fact that if we don't learn to understand those things that sit inside us, sometimes it's just a simple concern that we have when we're in the wrong neighborhood that indicates the prejudice that still resides inside us. If you get scared when you walk through a difficult an urban area that is not where the money resides, where the best education exists or is provided, you're signaling that there is a certain prejudice in that understanding that you should be scared being in that neighborhood. And I think we just want to ignore that. The same people that, again, young people today, they've got it figured out. Trust me, I had it figured out 30 years ago. And then along the way, I lost it all. I don't have anything figured out. And I think that's just common for all of us. And so we have to be real careful when we start judging, because as we judge and we point the finger at other people, that is really when we are allowing the darkest parts of ourselves to step out and be seen by others. And we're all guilty of it.
Well, Dr. LeBeau, this time on the couch has been really profound, and I thank you for it. No, I mean, and you didn't give me a catchy name, though. Let's pretend.
Catchy name.
I mean, come on. I gave you a question you'd never heard before. I'm going to
To be honest with you, I would use one that I put in the book, the foliage flogger.
The foliage flogger.
Yes, I would be the killer that would kill in the woods because I prefer woods over water. Forest and mountains over water. So I'm sure I would be a killer like the killer in here. And I'd get humor out of being called a foliage flogger.
But isn't flogging much like soft whipping, right?
Yeah, well, I would take my time. Come on now, I'm not going to, if I'm really having a good time with this, I'm not going to rush it.
Wait. In a world where one man is dangerous, he'll flog you to death, but it's going to take a long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're not going to rush it here. We're going to take all the necessary steps, and then we'll leave out telltale signs.
Oh, God, dude, that is so... Okay. Well, I don't know what...
Well, you asked.
Yeah, no. 100%. 100%. All right. Before we get to rapid fire questions and begin our wrap up, I always ask all authors their favorite piece of writing advice. It can be something you've learned from someone else, something you've read and picked up, your personal insight. What would you, Brian LeBeau, offer aspiring writers?
I think that the hottest thing for a writer to learn, but the most important thing for them to master, I'm not saying that I've done that, but I think you have to if you're going to be a successful writer, is to really get inside yourself. The world presents you all of this stimuli. You can travel, you can see other parts of the planet, you can visit different people, different cultures, learn things. But the fact of the matter is, the most interesting stories, the most interesting things that you can possibly ever witness are the ones that you're going to dream up in your own head. And so don't be afraid to put them on paper, because some people really are afraid to. They're afraid that other people will think that's who they are. Be honest, put it out there. We all have really strange dreams, fantasies, ideas about what we can and can't do. Let it out there and then let people judge and be willing to take the criticism. It's just a part of life. You're not going to succeed unless you get in the arena. Yeah. So just get in the arena and be full in, all in. Let it out there and let people critique it the way they want to.
That is awesome advice. And I got to tell you something. I get up very early in the morning so I can get reading in. And I was reading your book and I was making notes about another project that I'm working on. And I was making notes and they were very dark, dark underbelly of the world and so forth. And I won't go into any detail, but I thought, wow, how do you start your first day of the week with these kind of thoughts? And I'm like, well, it's just part of what we do, right? Back to your point, you can't judge that. We're just creating fiction, right? And some of those things reside in us and we aren't aware of it. Sometimes they reside and they bubble up, and that's when we get the germ of an idea to then go forth. But yeah, that's great advice, Brian. All right, rapid fire questions. Very easy. I'm going to take it easy on you. It's been a nice fourth holiday. You need to come back and go slow. You're on a long cross-country road trip with the family. Now, there's something, technology you may remember, that's called a CD. Maybe you didn't have a CD. Maybe it's satellite radio. But what I want you to do is tell me what station or genre of music you'd be listening to for that long drive across the country.
60s and 70s folk.
Oh, really?
Simon and Garfunkel.
Mamas and Pop. Yeah.
Mamas and Papas. Yeah, you can go right down the list. All of that.
Okay. First one. That's solid. I like that. All right. Now, as you depart for this long vacation at the end of that road trip, because we're going to pretend, because I was thinking you're in Massachusetts or something. Oh, he's going to drive across the country. Then he'll land in Los Angeles and fly to Hawaii for the holiday. Dude, I just make this stuff up. You can't do it. All right. So you've packed only two books. Only two books. What are they?
Dennis Lehane's Mystic River. And probably going all the way back to Jane Austen.
Oh, boy. Look at you, surprise boy. Dennis Lehane, we're talking about the Clint Eastwood movie, right? That is what popped into my... Oh.
If you want to... The print in Dennis Lehane's Mystic River is exactly the print I used in this novel because they're similar length.
Look at you, dude. Your attention to detail is off the chain. Wow. Okay. Wow. Always impressing me. Number three, finally. Disturbing Behavior has just been acquired by a Hollywood studio. Who do you see playing both leads, Mo Luhman and Detective Francis Palmer?
Okay, so Francis Palmer is very easy, a young Harrison Ford. That'd be exactly, even if you look at his description, that's him. Okay. But it would be his like witness period, early to mid 80s period for him.
Perfect.
For Mo Luhman, I don't think that you can use a big star. I think you're finding someone who's unknown. They should probably be fairly big. Think of The Green Mile when Michael Clark Duncan played that role. He was known, but he wasn't a big actor. Uh-uh. And so I think you have to do the same thing. You have to identify someone that's unknown for that role. And it's going to be a challenge. That is a hard role to play.
Yeah, yeah. He was a big actor in both stature and
presence. Really was.
All right, folks, to learn more, visit... Brian LeBeau. I always want to, would it be LeBeau? LeBeau? Would it be Franche?
LeBeau, the beautiful. Yeah. It's good for my wife, not so much for me.
Brian, the beautiful. Yeah, I would probably say it is more about your wife than you, but that's okay. BrianLeBeau.com. Follow him on Instagram as I do at Brian LeBeau Writer and Facebook at Brian K. LeBeau. Dude, this has been awesome.
David, I loved it. It was great fun.
I got to tell you something. I pulled up the map while we were talking. You are directly, as the crow flies, you're directly across. You're probably an hour from me.
Oh, not even. It takes about 45 minutes. My wife goes there to the beach constantly.
I do apologize that I did not know that because we would have sat down. We would have done it right here on the back veranda and right under the palm trees and enjoyed ourselves.
Nice. Well,
next time.
There's always next time. The next book comes out next year.
Beautiful. Well, keep us posted. Brian LeBeau, thank you again. Have a great rest of your week.
Thank you, David.
Now, there's a lively guy, right? Brian LeBeau, the book, A Disturbing Nature. Thanks again for joining us, Brian. Just another part of our Discovering New Author series. And as I said at the beginning of the show, you know, sometimes you want to kick off the new season with a bang. And I thought, you know, my bang is going to be a brand new author. How about that? Now, next week, as you heard at the top of the show, Brad Thor has a new book called Rising Tiger. I am going to start it today, as soon as I get off the show, as I prepare for Brad Thor next Thursday. So please put it on your calendars, make plans to attend. I do want to mention this. In 3 weeks, Dean Kuntz is going to be on the show. Dean's going to be on the 21st of this month, and this book right here is The Big Dark Sky. I have two copies of this that I'm going to be giving away to a lucky listener viewer in the Thriller Zone audience. Here's how easy it is to win. You're going to send me an email, number one. In the subject line, you're going to say, I want Dean Kuntz's latest book. Easy. And number three, inside the email, just simply tell me why you want this particular book. It can be that you're a huge fan, that you've never read them and you want to read them. That's all you got to do. P.S., tell me where you're writing from, whether it's down the street, across the country, around the world. That's all you got to do. 1, email thethrillerzone@gmail.com. 2, I want Dean Koontz's book in the subject line. 3, this is where I'm writing from and this is why I want the book. That's all you got to do. Yes, because you know what? I'm going to take all those entrants, I'm going to put them in a fishbowl, have my lovely and talented and brilliant wife, Tammy, reach in, pull out the winner, and we'll announce it on the show. That's all you got to do. Easy peasy. All right. I think that's about all our housekeeping that we need to do. So do me a favor. Join us next time, wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcast, or Google Podcast, or Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever it is. And of course, a lot of people just go right to the website, thethrillerzone.com, and they find out where they want to listen at that time. Either way, I'm David Temple, your host. Always a pleasure to see you and hear you and talk to you and communicate with you. And I'll see you next time for another edition of the new season of The Thriller Zone.